Strange Podcast. I am your host, Agent Anderson. Come along as we examine UFO sightings, conspiracies, and all things strange. You can find all of our wonderful links in the description on the Linktree, where you can find our Discord, our Patreon, our YouTube, and more. Merchandise? This week's episode, the Tujunga Pass Canyon UFOs. This is a fun one. I wanted to do this since I did a previous one that mentioned some sightings in the area, so I put it on the list, and you, our Patreon subscribers, voted for it. That's right, we've got a Patreon with three wonderful tiers for you. The first tier will get you early access, after hours, and live shows right now. I don't know if that's going to change in the future. I might put live shows for everybody and completely mix everything up and change the structure of everything. Go crazy, go nuts, but we'll see. Right now, it's the live shows are only on the Patreon. The second tier will get you bonus episodes. And the third tier will get you the ability to vote on upcoming topics. And this was one of the choices this week. Every time we do an episode, you guys get to vote on it. Ooh, shaky camera there. That's no good. I need a more sturdy desk for this one. All right, the Tujunga Canyon UFOs. Tujunga. It's spelled, let me put my notes on the side here. It's spelled Tujunga. Kind of a strange sounding name there. It sounds like it's maybe, I don't know, Mexican or, I mean, Spanish, because they used to live in the area in Southern California. I don't know about the history of the year of when that changed hands, but it did at some point, I'm pretty sure, from Spain or somebody. All right, anyways, let's not talk about world history. Let's get to the Tujunga Canyon UFOs. The Tujunga area is just north of Hollywood, California. And I've driven right through the area myself. Probably you have too, if you've been in Southern California. The 210 freeway goes right through the area. And if you're not familiar, the 210 is one of the major thoroughfares in Southern California. In fact, if you go anytime during daylight hours and often at night, you will be jammed with traffic. It's a very busy corridor. This case is not to be confused with the Topanga Canyon UFOs, a completely different incident that I put on the list, and hopefully we get to it some point in the future. That is also a good case. All right, this may sound familiar because I've talked about this before on the case that involved the hitchhiker effect or contagion. The idea actually kind of came from one of the cases in this area. In 1953, Sarah Shaw and Jan Whitley were staying in a remote cabin. They woke up at 2 in the morning and noticed that everything was strangely silent. They saw a blue-white light outside moving around and casting shadows on the walls. Jan got out of bed and got her robe out of the closet. She felt cold and had a headache. I guess maybe they'd been drinking and her blanket fell off. I don't know. I'm sure it was nothing to do with the UFO. Neither witness remembered anything else, but they both felt confused. The next thing they remember, it was 4:20 in the morning. And that was their experience. Weird lights. One of the witnesses said maybe it was people on motorcycles with nefarious purposes, but they soon realized that the lights were not moving like you would expect from motorcycles. I guess if you wake up in the middle of the night and you're freaked out about something, oh my God, motorcycles! Motorcycle gang or whatever. To be fair, this area at one point was infested with motorcycle gangs, but that wasn't until the 1990s. And they were in Tujunga proper, probably not as remote of an area as we're talking about here. If you look at a map of the area, there's cities and then there's areas outside of the city. that's a lot more remote. I'm going to take my mouse off this table. Every time I touch it, it just jiggles the camera. This is horrible. I use it on my lap now. All right. Anyways, so Jan got out of bed. Oh, wait, I already said that. Under hypnosis later on, they both remembered more to the encounter. They remembered that beings had approached the house and came through a closed window in the kitchen door. And it didn't say in this excerpt that I found, it didn't really say how they came through. Did they float through? Did they just dematerialize and come through a solid wall? It wasn't clear. It just said they came through a closed window in the kitchen door. There were eight shadowy beings altogether. And they entered the house and they put their hands on the women. When they touched the women, they felt like the aliens were controlling them. And one of the witnesses, that would be Sarah, felt calm and actually sort of felt like she was enjoying the experience, whereas Jan felt differently. She kind of freaked out and didn't like it one bit. The aliens themselves were slim with long, skinny arms, and one description said that their skin was dry and cold, but they were wearing coveralls and gloves, so I'm not sure how they could touch their skin. I don't know. That was a weird one. But their heads were oval-shaped. They apparently had no hair and no features except for eyes on their face. Getting freaked out yet? I know I am. No, thank you, right? The eyes were narrow and long and seemed to move behind a membrane. Again, no thank you. They wore black, skin-tight coveralls and had something similar to a ski mask on their faces. The clothes looked like they were sprayed on. Now, that was a strange detail that I saw, that I was trying to picture that. The clothes look sprayed on. And to me, that suggests that the clothing, it still looked like they were wearing some sort of clothing, but it was so thin and clung so tightly to their skin that it was, it looked like you could see their skin through it, I guess. I don't know. That's a strange detail. I'm not really sure what to make of it, but I don't know if their clothes looked like they were sprayed on. Maybe it wasn't their clothes at all. Who knows? The creatures were about 5 feet tall, and some had heads that were wider on the bottom rather than on top. Jan got the idea that these were female, but she didn't have any other reason to believe that. That was just sort of her intuition. The beings seemed to debate something while they were in the house, and Jan thought that they were debating whether or not to experiment on them in the cabin or take them to their craft. Well, of course, they decided to take them to their craft. Who wants to be experimented on inside of a lonely cabin, you know, in the middle of nowhere? So they took them back to the ship, or the UFO, which was hovering a little ways down the road. It was Saturn-shaped, or round, spherical-shaped with a rim around it that looked sort of like the planet Saturn. It glowed with colors that looked like mother of pearl and made a whining sound. Again, Sarah felt calm as they were being carried out or dragged out to the UFO, depending on your description that you find. One description I saw said that a beam of light was coming from the UFO and they were walking on the beam of light. That's kind of strange. Don't know what to make of it. As they were taking them to the UFO, Jan was struggling and trying to escape. The aliens or creatures or whatever they were, put her to sleep by giving her some kind of injection. Once they were inside the UFO, I guess Jan sort of woke up a little bit and continued to struggle during the examination. You know there's going to be an examination. There is a UFO story, you know, an abduction usually involves this sort of thing, probing and whatnot. They were in a room inside the UFO that was large and domed and seemed to have a balcony surrounding it. Sounds kind of like a TARDIS to me, right? It's bigger on the inside. But when they were in there, they saw a chair, control panels, and an exam table. They undressed Sarah and Jan and examined a surgical scar that Sarah had. The scar seemed to fascinate the creatures, and they examined it for quite some time, maybe like 10 minutes or something. Then they levitated her above a table and reassured her that she would be fine and that she would not be hurt as a device scanned her body. Yeah, it's fine. We're not going to probe you. We're just going to scan you, right? Jan was dragged in a completely different room and examined in that room. Sarah's memory jumped and Jan was standing next to her. And that's sort of a short version of the encounter. The aliens may or may not have played with Jan's boobs a little bit, and that may or may not have been very upsetting to her. there's a much longer version of that encounter available in several places, but I didn't want to spend the entire episode on that particular incident. I just wanted to go over it again. I mentioned it previously on the show, but I wanted to talk about it because it is probably the most famous of the Tujunga Canyon UFO sightings, although there are many from the area. In 1956, Jan once again had a UFO encounter. This time, she was driving with a friend, Emily Cronin, in the Tujunga area when their car was stopped by aliens. And Emily was abducted a year later, 1957, when she was by herself. Laura Briggs and Joe Main, her roommate, who were friends of Jan, were in 1975 had strange beings come into their house and took them to a UFO where they underwent an examination similar to Jan and Sarah's original encounter. And everybody that was abducted in these series of events was either, they were all friends of Jan Whitley in one way or another. And this is the first case we know of the hitchhiker effect or contagion. And there, I mentioned these, I won't go into the cases in detail. I just wanted to sort of mention and throw them out there before I talked about a few more cases from the Tujunga area. But there is a book about these cases called The Tujunga Canyon Contacts by Ann Druffel and D. Scott Rogo. And this is supposedly the second book ever written about alien abduction. Also, the authors actually coined the term contagion, aka the hitchhiker effect. So this is the six cases that started it all off, or at least they're the most famous of the Tujunga Canyon area by far, although they were not the only ones. And let's get to some of the other ones. So I found a bunch of cases from the area. Not as many as I thought I would find for a supposed UFO hotspot, but I did find a decent number of cases in the area. And if you expand your search just a little bit farther outside of the Tujunga Canyon area, it's right there nestled in northern Los Angeles. And if you expand your search just a little bit wider, you find a significant number of UFO cases in that area. We've talked about at least one of them, the the Battle of Los Angeles, which is a really interesting case. I think we had Braden from ATT on when we discussed that, but that was a really fascinating case that was sort of in the area. And there's a whole bunch more that I want to talk about. There's Catalina Island that's sort of near there and off the coast that has a UFO hotspot that I'm sure I'll get to eventually. It's on the list, as you might expect. So yeah, there's a lot going on in Southern California, particularly the Los Angeles area. I did pull up a map of UFO sightings. Just Google UFO sighting map. It's pretty interesting. And one thing I noticed about that map is that most of the sightings, like if you zoom out to a continent, you'll see that the sightings tend to correlate with where the population centers are. And that kind of makes sense because where there are more people, there will be more sightings because they're just simply more people to see things. So that seems pretty intuitive. Was not too surprising about, as far as that goes. But it was fun to see where all the hot spots are. And some areas do have a disproportionate number of UFO sightings. And that's where the fun ones are. All right, so let's get to the Tujunga Canyon. October 9th, 1967. Three people saw a UFO in Tujunga Canyon and drove towards it. As they approached, their car broke down. One witness stayed behind and tried to fix the car. The other two witnesses went on foot towards the UFO. As they approached, they saw a hovering object and felt an electric sensation. They saw a ball of fire appear nearby. At this point, their memories became disjointed, and they don't really remember anything after that. But the next day, they were found by sheriff's deputies wandering around in a confused state. So there are some differences, but there are also some similarities, notably the missing time and the sense of confusion, which is not something that I personally would be looking forward to. Can you imagine, you know, you wake up or you just come to and you're wandering around and you don't know where you've been or what's happened to you. It's just scary stuff, man. And just the descriptions of those UFOs previously with, they were wearing, black coveralls. And I think, did I forget to mention, they were wearing what appeared to be a ski mask covering their face. They had no facial features, just these totally black creatures with slanty eyes. No, no, thank you. Creeps me out, dude. All right, next one I have here for you, September 3rd, 1975. The Tujunga community, this took place in the Tujunga community, where there are houses built into the side of mountains. Just out of curiosity, I was looking on Zillow or Redfin or whatever it was earlier, because I've driven through the area and I was wondering, how much are these houses? You don't want to know. They are a lot. I found some modestly priced houses that were a little on the small side, maybe 1,000 to 1,500 square feet, somewhere in the ballpark of $1 million in this area. And then, of course, if you're talking about something on the hillside, it goes way up. Start, you know, probably $1.5 million to $2.5 million and on up, depending on what you're looking to get. But it would still, if you're curious to look at some beautiful houses, check out the houses in this area. They're built in the side of mountains. They have beautiful views. I have a view. There's a 7-Eleven. No, I'm just kidding. But there is. That's my view of 7-Eleven. I wish I could live on a hill like these places. Anyways, I'm rambling. Let's get back to Tujunga. The houses are built into the side of the mountains, and one couple, Mr. and Mrs. Cromwell, live in one of these houses built onto the side of the mountain. At 8 o'clock on September 3rd, 1975, Mrs. Cromwell heard a helicopter. She went outside and watched it fly past, and she said it looked like it was about 1,200 feet high. Her sister, Mrs. Brandt, was also with her. 1,200 feet, that's pretty low. It's lowish. It's going to be making a lot of noise, and you'll definitely notice it. You'll hear it if you're even inside your house, depending on the helicopter, but helicopters are pretty damn loud, so chances are. I didn't do it that time. That was my dog that bumped the desk. I got a pretty flimsy desk. All right, so anyways, they were outside and they heard the helicopter flying around. They went to look at it. And as they were looking at the helicopter, they saw a round, bright object above the helicopter. They couldn't really see it all that well. So Mrs. Cromwell went in and got some binoculars to look at it. Through the binoculars, she was able to see that the object was disc-shaped and had a blue-green top, white middle, and glowing red bottom. Pretty interesting combination of colors there. Almost red, white, and blue, but it was blue-green on top, so not quite. America! That was an American UFO, people. So it was stationary while she looked at it for a little while the helicopter circled the area as if it was looking for something. The object then changed shape from round to diamond to chevron, and then to the classic flying saucer shape. And as I was reading this, I was wondering if the object was changing shape physically, or if it was perhaps rotating, Or maybe if it's using some propulsion method like the Alcubierre drive that bends space-time around the object rather than traveling through space-time like we do, you know, it's primitive Earthlings. Maybe by bending that space-time, it causes what the object looks like to change, but the object itself is not actually changing shape. That's one thought that occurred to me. That's occurred to me before when I've read these sorts of descriptions, but who knows? Anybody's guess is as good as mine. It's definitely a bizarre description, and we've seen this before with other UFO cases, the object changing shape. It's not all that unusual, actually. After it changed shape to a classic saucer, it zigzagged over the area. And at this time, somewhere around this time, Mr. Cromwell had come out to join the ladies outside. Possibly they were out there oohing and aahing and making a ruckus, and he was thinking, hey, I'm just trying to enjoy my basketball game in here. What's all the ruckus out there? Ah, see here. You know, that's how they used to talk back then. The helicopter then flew off, but later, shortly, two more helicopters returned, flying in tandem, so flying in formation next to each other. At about 11 o'clock, the object disappeared to the west, followed by the helicopters. After the incident, all three witnesses had blurred vision, bloodshot eyes, and felt as if they had experienced a sunburn. That's kind of alarming, considering that the UFO wasn't super close to them. I think they said the UFO seemed like it was about 1,000 feet above the helicopters, and if it was causing some sort of physiological effect, it's kind of scary, kind of creepy, guys. I don't know. I don't know what to make of it. I don't like it one bit. Get those UFOs out of here if they're causing radiation damage. There was a very similar case in Enfield, Connecticut on March 4th, 1975. I didn't take detailed notes on this one because, you know, it wasn't in the Tahunga Pass, but it was very, very similar. It had similar colored lights and the object move in a similar way. So maybe I'll talk about that at some point in the future. I don't know. Probably not. There's so many UFO cases, you can't get to all of them. But I just found that interesting that there was a case that was nearly identical in Connecticut. That far away, you have an independent witness on March 4th, 1975. So it's not, you know, on the exact day, but it is the same year. So September 3rd, the one in Tahunga was a few months after the one in Connecticut. So that's pretty interesting. I don't know. I don't know what to make of it. But there are similarities there. All right. Now, I have a couple more cases that I found here. These I got from New Fork, which is an online database and reporting center for UFO sightings. This one happened on 8/10/1951. So this is the earliest one I was able to find. That happened a long time ago. That was, you know, just at the beginning of the so-called modern UFO era, starting with Kenneth Arnold in 1947. Although some people say it started with the Foo Fighters. It just depends on who you're asking. Anyways, witnesses saw a smooth, aerodynamic-looking craft descending towards them and passing overhead. And after it passed overhead, it climbed back up. It was about 100 feet in diameter and appeared to hug the terrain at an altitude of 1,000 feet as it traveled along. It was going really fast. The witnesses estimated it was 700 miles an hour. But if you're seeing something on the ground and you're not really sure something in the air, you have no frame of reference. You don't know how big it is. You don't know how far away it is. It's all just an estimate, but 700 feet is about the speed of sound, give or take. So whatever it was going extremely fast. Who knows? Maybe it was 700. Maybe it was more, maybe it was less. It could have been, you know, if it was low flying, it could have been 200 miles an hour. And it would have still seemed like it was going extremely fast. And you might think 700. If it's higher up, very, very high up, it could be going much faster. It just depends on how far away it is. When the object was seen from the front, it had an oval bubble shape on top and bottom, like it was symmetrical, with an outer ring section. Almost, you could describe it kind of like the UFO that they saw in the early Tohunga Pass abductions that Jan saw. Kind of looked like Saturn, right? I mean, that's another way of describing it, possibly, which I find very interesting that you have another independent report here that sounds an awful lot like the other one. When seen from the bottom, the ring section appeared to be rotating at a high speed with no visible gap, but with a definite line of separation. I thought that was really interesting. I have seen other reports, other cases where there was a spinning disc on the outside of the object. I didn't see anything like that in Jan and Sarah's encounter or any of the other Tohunga encounters with the original cluster of six with a contagion incident, but it's still right there in line with what Jan saw, and it could be a similar object. We don't know for sure. The object was surrounded by a bright, continuous blue electrical arc that didn't touch the craft, and this gave off a stream of orange and white sparks. That's a fairly unique description. I can't think of a whole lot of cases that had like this blue arc. They called it an arc, but you know, I'm thinking in my head, I'm picturing that as like this bright blue halo surrounding the craft that doesn't actually touch the craft. Sparks, I've heard of sparks before. That's not completely unusual, but this halo is really interesting. I can't think of another case where I remember hearing that. Although, of course, I have read about many, many cases with a glow of some kind that emanated from the craft. But this one, the fact that it didn't touch the craft is sort of a new way of describing it. I don't remember hearing that before. The witness for this particular case worked in aircraft assembly in Burbank, and when he went to work and told his coworkers what he had seen, I've got a fly on my eyebrow there or something. He went to work and told his coworkers about the incident, and of course, they laughed at him and ridiculed him endlessly, well, probably for at least a couple of weeks. And after that, he didn't really tell anybody or want to talk about it anymore. The sighting, he said, lasted a total of about 4 seconds or so. So it was really quick. He saw it flew overhead and then it was gone. 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 1,000, gone. So that's pretty fast. And that's a really interesting description. One of the better cases, at least I really like this description because he's describing something that doesn't sound terrestrial, especially not in 1951. It's hard to believe that that was something that we could have made. And those are my favorite kind of cases, historic cases from back in the day when we did not have advanced technology. So it probably was not something that we built. Well, I guess our technology was advanced back then, depending on how, you know, it's all relative. But those are my favorite cases, the ones where we didn't have drones, we didn't have advanced aircraft like we do now. These days, if you see something weird flying around, could be a drone, could be something top secret. Who the heck knows what kind of top secret spy planes or objects that the government's developed? I believe that we probably have invisible ships, that we probably have, you know, invisible airplanes, that we probably have things, technologies that you can't imagine. I remember, you know, when I was younger, back in the day, they would sort of advertise our weapons of war and sort of leak what we had, maybe to freak out the enemy, maybe to freak out Russia, to try to get them to build more stuff. I had a history professor who once said that we beat Russia on economics. We just outspent them. They couldn't keep up with us, I guess. It was just a scale of economy. We just kept building war machines and developing new war machines. So they had to try to keep pace with us, right? And eventually that bankrupted them. And that's why the Soviet Union had to dissolve. It was an economic dissolution more than anything. I'm not an expert, but hey, that's what some smart guy told me one time. So maybe when they leaked all those spy planes and all that stuff back in the day, they were doing so to try to get Russia to compete with us, you know, to build bigger and better things. Or maybe there are other reasons. Who knows? Maybe there are multiple reasons. I don't know. But in any case, they don't seem to have been doing that the last couple of decades. They keep that stuff under wraps a little bit more. So who knows what they have? There are rumors about things, but we don't know for sure. At least I don't. And I think it's possible that we could have some craft with something like the El Cubieri drive. I think people could have built that by now. And I think it could be out there and maybe could be causing some UFO sightings. Not in 1951, however. I don't think that would happen in 1951. All right, so let's move along here. Fast forwarding quite a bit. I didn't do all of the ones in the New Fork database. I just picked and chose a few of them. This one is from March 31st, 2009. There were two witnesses that saw an object at a low altitude traveling east to northwest. It looked like it was one object with two orbs on the object. The object itself was cigar-shaped and it glowed dimly. They said that it drifted out of sight. This one was not super specific, but it suggests the object was low altitude, silent, hovering around, and gliding, or they said it was like floating. So it was just going by real slow and silently, maybe, or they weren't really, they use words like drifted, so they weren't real specific about speeds, but now I'm imagining that the object is not going super fast. It's just kind of going, you know, at a leisurely pace. Cigar shape, could it have been a blimp? Blimps do fly in this area. At least they did, you know, at some point. I'm not sure if blimps are still around. The Goodyear blimp, I haven't seen it in years. But when I was in Southern California, you would see it occasionally flying around. So, I mean, that is one possibility. I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. And the blimps, they're pretty quiet, you know. But on the other hand, they do have big rotors, like propeller blades. You can see on there. And you can see like the little canopy or whatever it is hanging on the bottom. Gondola? Would you call that a gondola? I don't know. But you can see that. So it's maybe not a blimp. I don't know. All right. Next up, on May 13th, 2010, at 9:27 p.m., a witness was outside stargazing, looking at the Big Dipper specifically, when they saw an object moving to the north. It disappeared and reappeared 20 to 30 miles to the north. Now, I'm guessing that's just a rough estimate because how are you going to really, you're just standing there looking, how are you going to know what the distance really is? But the point being is that they were in the area, they probably had a good view. They're probably up on a hill or a mountain and they could see pretty far, and the object just disappeared and then reappeared at a great distance further along. When it reappeared, it shot to the west at a high rate of speed, appearing to descend at the same time. As it descended, it got larger as it did so. It had no plume and made no noise. No plume meaning no stream, jet stream or trail or engine exhaust or anything like that. Pretty weird. What was it? Don't know. All right, next up, I have one from, not August, what am I thinking? I'm so out of it today. From April 26, 2011. A witness stepped outside for a cigarette at 0:30 hours, so 12:30 in the morning, or the middle of the night, as it would be, and the witness was also on the phone with their boyfriend. They saw an object in the sky that appeared to be at a high altitude. It was circular, a faint red, and looked blurred, like it had a motion blur to it, kind of like if you're watching something on the TV. And this is a newer TVs don't have this problem as much, so you know, younger listeners may not be familiar depending on your television set, but older televisions would have a lower frame rate or a lower refresh rate, so something that would move quickly would have a motion blur to it, you know, anything, sporting games, car chases, whatever. So I think that's what they meant. It looked like it had motion blur. Pretty weird. It moved in a zigzag pattern for a little bit and then suddenly stopped. It descended and then ascended and then shot off to the witness's left. Here's a quote. It was there, and the next moment it was just gone. The witness went back inside for 30 minutes, a little freaked out, but was feeling restless, couldn't get back to sleep. So she came back outside to look around a little bit more. She said kind of to like reassure herself or something. I don't know. Probably if you saw something like that, you're going to think, oh, I must be crazy. I don't know what the hell's going on. I'm just going to peek back outside to make sure that, you know, outside is still there and I'm not like imagining something or other. I don't know. So she went back outside and was hanging out for about 30 minutes or an hour or something like that and saw the object again. This time it went in the opposite direction. In other words, from the witness's left to the right. As it traveled, it made little corkscrew turns extremely fast and smoothly. So it was little tight corkscrews, I'm guessing. It appeared brighter this time and was larger. Presumably, it was closer to the witness on this pass. It flew off in the direction, the witness said there was a dam in the direction that it flew, that left to the right of the witness. She stayed outside looking for the object to return and saw it two more times over the next hour. First, it flew back to the left on a straight path, moving very quickly. The second time it came back, she was looking up and it seemed to just appear in the area she was looking, just appeared out of nowhere in the area of the Little Dipper and made strange maneuvers. It zipped around like it was drawing a pattern, like a star or an octagon or something like that in the sky. The witness said, just left, right, forward, back, but all extremely fast. And then while it was doing this, it would disappear and reappear several times. Eventually, after disappearing, it did not appear back, and that was the last time she saw it. She stayed out for about another hour, but it did not return, and she said she was very tired at work the next day. I can imagine. That was a really crazy one, you know, multiple sightings. Was it the same object? Was it different objects? Who knows? She only ever saw one at once, and the witness seemed to believe that it was the same object just returning, but we don't know. All right, and then next up, I've got one from January 18th, 2014. The witness saw a reddish light move up from the Little Tahunga Mountain. It went up and down very quickly, like a yo-yo. And we've seen this in other UFO sightings. In fact, the one I just read said that it went up and down, at least one of them. I think, was that the one that went up and down? Yeah, whatever. But this is not super uncommon to see them going up and down. But this one, it went up and down extremely quickly. And I thought, that's kind of strange. That's not how you would expect a physical craft to behave, just jerking up and down really quickly. And it made me think, what if we're seeing an object that's sort of out of place, at least out of time? You know, as far as time goes, it's out of place. If something can move, if it can be like an Alcubierre drive that can sort of displace time and space, why wouldn't it look like this, right? So you might be seeing it differently, right? It might be in different places at the same time or something like that. I don't know. I'm babbling here, but I think you know what I mean, right? It's sort of defying the linear experience of time that we have, I guess. I don't know. Does that make sense? I hope so. So anyways, after it went up and down very quickly, it then went to the east at a high rate of speed, but it was going slower than the up and down motion, which makes me think that when it was going up and down, was it going up and down so fast that it was almost a streak of light? Because that's what it sounds like. That's weird, man. I don't know what to make of that. And that's that one. That's that sighting. All right. And the next one is on August 1st, August 1st, 2014, witnesses saw six lights, sort of like stars, fly in a circle formation, and then a V formation, and then that formation flew off at a very high rate of speed. They don't estimate the speed, they just say it was very quickly. So I'm just imagining something that's just there, and then boom, it streaks off and it's gone. And that's that one, really short sighting. The next one happened June 22nd, 2017. A witness was hiking at 10 in the morning when they saw a round, pulsating, metallic sphere gliding along the foothills. It stopped and hovered for 10 minutes and then slowly moved out of sight. Creepy. That sounds a lot like the Betz sphere, right? It's just this metallic sphere moving along. I wonder if this is an object similar to the Betz sphere, only, you know, not malfunctioning and broken. Pretty interesting. That's all there was to this one. The witness speculated that it might be, you know, like a Mylar balloon or something like that, but they dismissed that because it didn't look like a Mylar balloon. And it would be possible, but I'm just imagining it, and I've seen Mylar balloons floating around. They tend to have a particular motion. It would be possible for a Mylar balloon to come into and be blown into an area and then stay in that area for 10 minutes before moving on. But balloons, I'm sure you've all seen them floating around. They're never perfectly still. Even when it's in an area, it's going to be moving around a little bit. Right, there's always like a little bit of a breeze outside. It's never perfectly still. So I find it hard to believe that a Mylar balloon could create such a sight as this. But anything's possible, I suppose. Why not? All right. And the last one I've got for you here for today for the Tujunga Pass from August 9th, 2019 at 2 a.m. A witness saw a red color out of their peripheral vision. They opened their window and looked around, and they saw a giant, spheric, circle-looking thing pulsing a red color. That's a quote. That's how they described it. It was pulsing a red color and blue colors. We've had a couple of them already with the red and blue colors. Sounds kind of familiar. They took a video, but their phone mysteriously failed later on that day. So they went to check their phone again. Phone was broken. Kind of weird. Strange coincidence, right? Maybe they're watching us. Well, we know they're watching us, but are they filtering our phones for UFO videos? I don't know, maybe. Let's say this thing was some sort of experimental craft that wasn't supposed to be there. It went off course, or its invisibility field broke down or whatever, and you videotape it with your phone, and that sends out like a little flag to the NSA. Somebody reviews it and they're like, okay, nuke the phone. Boom. Well, they can't have that. We don't want evidence of that thing out there. Maybe, who knows? I don't know. We can speculate. Maybe it's just a coincidence. Phones do fail all the time. Well, not all the time, but occasionally they fail. Stuff breaks. So who knows? Maybe just a coincidence. But also, you could say, if you're a skeptic, you might say, yeah, right, your phone just so happened to break. Uh-huh, sure, buddy, right. I don't know. That's what a skeptic might think. I like to give people the benefit of the doubt, but anything's possible. All right, well, those are the UFO sightings I had for today for the Tujunga Pass, Tujunga Canyon area. I tried to get a copy of UFO Cat. Let's see here if I have it yet. UFO Cat 2023. It cost $10. I paid for it earlier today from NICAP or whatever, and they haven't sent it to me yet. I don't see it. Yep, checking my email again, and it's still not here, unfortunately. Because I mentioned it on a recent bonus episode. I think the Rockefeller briefing document talks about UFO Cat. And they have over 300,000 entries. It's just a database. They're not super detailed from what I understand. It's more like a database, like a listing of sightings. But 300,000 entries, I was curious to see what I could find in there for the Tujunga Pass. But unfortunately, I was not emailed that document in time for this episode. Maybe if I get it soon, I can do a search and do like a little bonus episode on what was in there, or maybe a supplementary episode to this. I don't know. Who knows? But all right, well, that's all I've got for you this week. Unfortunately, it's a little short this time. None of the other agents were able to join me. So you get a bigger view of my webcam. You see my little alien up there next to my speaker. And I think that's a Darth Vader. You know, my sound panel, my printer. I hate that damn fucking printer. I hate that damn thing. So, you know, if it was more of us, you would just get like this. So you get a view of my living room. Exciting stuff, right? But anyways, that's all we got for you this time. Thank you guys so much for listening. And if you enjoyed this show, you can really help us out by giving us a good review wherever you listen to podcasts and suggesting the show to your friend. And now that we're on a video format, sorry guys, I'm behind. If you're listening to this, we do have video formats on YouTube and possibly other outlets once I get around to it. And if you're watching this on YouTube, we also have an audio only version. So if you're watching this on YouTube, give us a thumbs up. It really, really helps out with the algorithms to get our stuff discovered. And there's also the notifications that helps as well. If you want those to happen, you may not, I don't know. But anyways, if you do all that stuff, it really helps out the show and we appreciate it. Until next time, keep it strange.